the privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teaching of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. When we become Buddhists, first we make repentance, and then we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. These refuges are the first of the 16 precepts that we receive in the Japanese Soto Zen tradition established by Dogen Zenji. Without these three, there is no Buddhism. Without these three, there's no bodhisattva who lives by vow instead of by karma. Karma means habit or preferences or ready-made systems of thought. Vow is like a magnet that shows us the direction toward Buddha. Living by vow changes how we inhabit ourselves as we walk. A vow is a means, and a vow in action is a dynamic means to accomplish a particular intention. And in practice, there are two kinds of vows. There's a general vow, and there's a particular to each individual vow. And our general vows are the bodhisattva vows that come right out of the Four Noble Truths that we talked about in our last session. And so that you fully understand this connection, we spent a series talking about the Four Noble Truths, and now the general vow of this series that we won't be spending much more time talking about after today, but it's the bodhisattva vows, and they're almost the same thing. So I'll tell you about that today. And then I'm going to, most of the time in this series, we're going to be talking about individual vows. And I want to tell you the life stories of five different Soto Zen masters, three of them, grandfather, father, person today. It's very interesting how they're related. And each one of them, without knowing their vow beforehand, just by hearing their life story, you will know their vow, because they lived their vow that fully. And as we listen to these stories of five Soto Zen masters, three of them are in this lineage, and two are directly related to them. So that it's all a family, including Suzuki Roshi. So this is all closely connected with Suzuki Roshi's lineage also. But as we listen to the stories that I'll be telling you starting in, I think, the fourth talk, because I want to talk a little bit more about vows and all that before that. But as I tell you those stories, you can be thinking about your own life story and how you will live out your own vow. And today, I'm going to tell you how to start making your own personal vow. Regarding general vows, here's a story of the origin of Shakyamuni Buddha's vow to become a Buddha. And I may have told you this story once before, but it's absolutely right directly related to this series and the subject. If need be, I'm going to repeat myself. So it comes out of the Nikaya, a certain Nikaya of the Pali Canon. And one part of this Nikala is the Jakata stories. There's 547 tales of Shakyamuni Buddha's previous lifetimes. And one of them is of Sumedha. And when he took a vow to become a Buddha, Buddha Dipankara predicted that Sumedha would successfully attain Buddhahood in a future life. And so this story illustrates the origin of the Bodhisattva vow and many of the important points of Bodhisattva practice. So it's interesting that the archetypal image of a Bodhisattva was already in place in the Pali Nikayas, which are very, very old. I'm not good at when things happen, but Pali is before the whole Sanskrit scene. So this story took place countless eons ago in a city called Amaravati, where lived a Brahmin named Sumedha. And when Sumedha was still young, his parents died, and a minister of state brought Sumedha to see all of the jewels and wealth and property that he's now inheriting that had been accumulating for seven generations. And when he saw this treasure, he thought, after amassing all this wealth, none of my ancestors were able to take even a penny with them when they passed away. Can it be right that I should seek to take my wealth with me when I go? Then he told the steward that he would give all his wealth to the poor and leave home to become a spiritual practitioner. He saw that life transmigrating within samsara, that is the cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death that all of us go through, was suffering, and that he wanted to find a path of deliverance into nirvana. Once one attains enlightenment or nirvana, one no longer transmigrates through these cycles. So that is, you're beyond birth and death. I mean, that's what we're really talking about in Buddhism. You know, it's about leaving the cycle of birth and death. That's the fundamental core of what we're doing here, which is like an amazing thing. So Sumedha is thinking, suppose a man, after falling into a heap of filth, like samsara, hears about a distant pond covered with lotuses of five colors, nirvana. In this, that man ought to search for that pond. If he does not, it's not the pond's fault. And in the same way, there is a lake, the great deathless nirvana, in which to wash off the defilements of my harmful karma. If I do not seek it, it will not be the lake's fault. So he left home and entered a forest in the Himalayas to practice as a hermit. Because he was a person of great capability, he attained superhuman knowledge and superhuman power. But while he was practicing this way, Dipankara Buddha appeared in the world and started to teach. And Dipankara Buddha visited a city not far from where Sumedha was living. The people of that city invited the Buddha and his assembly for a meal. And in preparation, they began to fix the road, which was flooded, and decorated with flowers. Sumedha flew there by means of his supernatural power and asked why they were working so hard and were so excited. And they explained, well, Dipankara Buddha was coming and Sumedha offered to help. And because they knew he had supernatural powers, they gave him the road to fix, the muddy road. But he said, he easily could have done that, but he wanted to do it by hand. So he started carrying the soil by hand, but he didn't finish before Dipankara Buddha arrived. But Sumedha didn't want the Buddha to walk in the mud. So he loosened his matted hair and laid down on the ground and asked the Buddha to walk on him, a dramatic expression of his commitment to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Even today, some Buddhists make prostrations that way, laying fully down on the ground. When Sumedha, lying in the mire, looked up at Dipankara Buddha, he made a vow. If I want, I could now enter the Buddhist Sangha and practice meditation to free myself from deluded human desires and become an arhat. Then at death, I would at once attain nirvana and cease to be reborn. But this would be a selfish course to pursue, for thus I should benefit myself only. I want to help all beings, like Dipankara Buddha is now doing. I am determined. I vow to attain what Dipankara Buddha attained and benefit all beings. Upon seeing Dipankara Buddha, Sumedha abandoned his earlier intention to escape from samsara and now aspired to live like a Buddha, staying in samsara to help all living beings. He would be the last to attain nirvana. He would help all others before himself. That's what a bodhisattva does. So Dipankara Buddha, seeing Sumedha lying in the mud, understood that the young man had vowed to become a Buddha. He told his assembly that in the distant future, Sumedha would become a Buddha named Gotama. Hearing this prediction, Sumedha was thrilled and he believed his vow would be realized. Having praised Sumedha for his vow, Dipankara Buddha and his assembly left, and thus Sumedha became the Bodhisattva, which in this case means the Buddha to be. This is an early example of the path called Bodhisattva practice, chosen by Shakyamuni Buddha. So again, regarding vows, there are two kinds, general and personal, and our general overarching vows are the four bodhisattva vows, which arise right out of the Four Noble Truths. And I think this comparison is really interesting. And so I'm going to explain it a little further. So here are our four bodhisattva vows. And by the way, you don't have to take them like formally. You can, but you can also take them in your heart. You can take them in your heart and you can practice them and have them be your way of life. So these are the four bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. And the older version of these four vows is as follows. And in a way, they feel more accurate to me. I vow to enable people to be released from the truth of suffering. That's the first noble truth, remember? The first noble truth is that there is suffering. Suffering exists everywhere. So the first of the old version of the Bodhisattva vows is, I vow to enable people to be released from the truth of suffering. The first noble truth of suffering. Secondly, I vow to enable people to understand the truth of the origin of suffering. Third, I vow to enable people to peacefully settle down in the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the Eightfold Noble Path. Fourthly, I vow to enable people to enter the cessation of suffering, that is nirvana. So the first bodhisattva vow here is related to the first noble truth. I vow to enable people to be released from suffering. And by the way, the suffering referred to here is not limited to the pain, suffering, and unhappiness or sadness brought about by the circumstances of our lives. The deeper meaning of dukkha or suffering is related to impermanence or egolessness. Everything is impermanent and always changing. As a result, there's nothing substantial. There is nothing. And yet we continue to try. But since everything continues to change, we suffer. And this suffering arises because we cannot possess or control anything. And as long as we try, we suffer and we feel dissatisfaction. Understanding that this desire to control and to get a hold of things is the origin of suffering. That is the second of the Four Noble Truths. And then the third vow is in the older verse, I vow to enable people to peacefully settle down in the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. This is the fourth noble truth, the truth of Marga, the path that leads to nirvana. The order of the truths is different in these two versions, but the path referred to is our practice of the Eightfold Noble Path, right view, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. We covered those in our last series. This third vow has to do with the fourth noble truth, to enable people to settle in the way of practice. It begins, the dharmas are boundless. Here, the original word for dharma is bomon, which means dharma gate, which means teachings about reality and reality-based practice. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them means we vow to study and settle down in the way of practice. This is the fourth noble truth and the third vow. And this is interesting. An older version of the fourth vow, the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it, is I vow to enable people to attain nirvana. This vow is related to the third noble truth. In this context, way is a translation to bodhi or awakening, not of marga or path. And so the Buddha's way refers to the Buddha's awakening or nirvana. So this vow says, the Buddha's awakening is unsurpassable, and I vow to attain it. It's interesting. It changes it altogether. The Buddha's awakening is unsurpassable, as opposed to the Buddha's way, the Buddha's path is unsurpassable. It's very interesting. But there's another interesting point. So listen again to the older version of the four vows. I enable people to be released from the truth of suffering. I enable people to understand the truth of the origin of suffering. I vow to enable people to peacefully settle down in the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And I vow to enable people to attain nirvana. In this version of the Four Noble Vows, I refers to a bodhisattva who has taken vows, been released from suffering, and understands the truth of the origin of suffering. This is somebody who already has settled down in practice in the Four Noble Truths, somebody who already has attained nirvana. These vows are for someone who was already enlightened. However, the verse we usually recite, once again, is sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. This person, the I here, still has inexhaustible desires and delusions, and so still has something to study and to learn. This person has not attained the way. The person still has inexhaustible delusive desires and therefore vows to eliminate them. This is not a vow to help others to be released from inexhaustible desires. The older version is a vow made by an already enlightened bodhisattva, somebody who is above all deluded sentient beings, making a vow to help all people. So in the newer version, the one we now chant, we still suffer, but we vow to save all beings. We have inexhaustible desires, but we vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. There are many things we have to learn, but we vow to master them. And we must make an effort to study the dharmas and the teachings, but we realize that practice is endless, and so we dissolve the practice endlessly. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We're not yet enlightened, but we vow to attain it. We are ordinary human beings, and yet, if we take these four vows, we are bodhisattvas. In reality, we are ordinary human beings with inexhaustible desires. We have to study the teachings, and we practice endlessly, day by day, moment by moment, to attain the Buddha's way and enlightenment. That is our vow. And in making these four vows, we are bodhisattvas. In making these vows, which I'm saying you can make in your heart, the fact of the contradiction inherent in these vows, that we vow to do things that are impossible, means that our practice is endless and that we cannot possibly fulfill them. Our practice and study are like trying to empty the ocean with a spoon, one spoonful at a time. It is certainly a stupid way of life, not a clever one. A clever person cannot be a bodhisattva. We are aiming at something eternal, infinite, and absolute, no matter how hard we practice and study and help other people. There's no end to it all. When we compare our achievement with something infinite, absolute, and eternal, it's like nothing. We shouldn't compare our practice and understanding and achievements with those of other people. When we do, we become competitive. We think, I'm better than them, or I'm practicing harder. Our practice becomes a competition based on egocentricity, something totally meaningless in the practice of the Buddha way. We cannot peacefully settle down in such a competitive practice, no matter how hard or long we practice. If our practice is based on ego, we are totally deluded. Such practice leads to selfish view and to arrogance and to self-attachment. Even though we think we're practicing the Dharma, we're against the Dharma completely. Even though we think we are practicing the Dharma, we are against the Dharma completely. When we understand that our goal is eternal, infinite, and absolute, no matter how hard we practice, no matter how many things we master, no matter how deep our understanding of the Buddha's teaching, compared to the infinite, we are zero. We cannot afford to be arrogant. But there's another side to this, which is, and this other side is the reason I'm telling you about this. Even if we cannot practice as hard, sit as long, study as much, or understand as deeply as others, we don't need to feel guilty or inferior. This is a really important point. And actually, this is the main point. We don't need to feel inferior, even if we can't practice hard, sit long, study and understand things, we still don't need to feel guilty or inferior. Compared to the eternal, the absolute and infinite, we're all zero anyway. There's something deeply meaningful in our comparison to the absolute. Understanding ourselves in this way frees our practice from comparison based on selfishness. This is an important point because we cannot be proud of our practice, but we don't need to be too humble about our lack of practice or understanding either. We just are as we are. Our practice is to take one more step toward the infinite, the absolute, moment by moment, one step at a time. And by the way, this is the way to do everything, not just Zen practice. This is the way to do everything, one step at a time, and don't even think about finishing. Just, is this step right here, right now, the best I can do? That's all you have to worry about ever in anything you do. Is this step right here, right now, the best I can do? That's all. And the difficulty there is you have to learn to trust your judgment of whether you're doing your best. But that's a good thing to learn. It's a very good thing to learn, to trust your judgment about what's the best in you, your best effort. According to Dogen Zenji, this one step or even half step in our practice is the manifestation of absolute enlightenment. This is what he meant when he spoke of just sitting or shikantaza. When we sit, we just sit. That doesn't mean we don't need to do anything else. It doesn't mean that we're all right only when we're sitting. It means that when we sit, there's no comparison. We are right now, right here, with this body and mind, awakening to reality. This is the complete manifestation of the absolute, infinite, eternal enlightenment, Dogen says. Even a short period of sitting is bodhisattva practice. And our practice is not only sitting. All of our day-to-day activities should be based on the bodhisattva vows and the Four Noble Truths, which are the basic teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. So even if you don't want to get into the bodhisattva vows, you can practice the Four Noble Truths. The very basic teachings that, as we know now, the Buddha taught them in the beginning, he taught them in the middle, and he taught them on his deathbed. So there's nothing wrong with the Four Noble Truths, and you can stay with them for your whole life, for the whole duration. The four bodhisattva vows are not an essential point, not just our practice of Zazen, but also in our day-to-day lives. Each of us has a job or a family, and in each situation, we try to practice the Four Noble Truths are the four bodhisattva vows. Our practice is the whole of our life. It's not something special that we do in a monastery or on retreat or in Sachin. The Buddha taught us to just awaken to the reality of our lives and to live on the basis of that reality. We live right now, right here, with this body and this mind in the company of others. The guiding force and the compass that leads us to live out this reality is the Bodhisattva vow, which is our general set of vows. And whenever I say that, you can substitute the Four Noble Truths as well. They're, as I just showed you, they're almost exactly the same. So here's a poem by Katagiri Roshi that actually I think it's lovely and it's simple, and it shows us this dilemma that we're in really clearly, I think. It's called Peaceful Life. Being told that it is impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know. What a mystery a human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will just practice right here now and achieve continuity endlessly forever. That's Katagiri Roshi's poem. I think it's really so expressive of everything I just talked about. So today, instead of giving you ideas to reflect upon during the week, I'm going to give you 10 questions to answer before you write your personal vow. So by the end of this series, I hope that you will have written your own personal vow. And as I said, I'll be giving you 5 life stories whose, just by telling these stories, you will know the vow of the person. And I would like to help you write your personal vows so that you can organize the rest of your this lifetime around them and feel when you die that you have done everything that you wanted. So again, instead of giving you reflection questions, I'm going to give you these 10 questions to answer in order to write your personal vow. And they will be posted on the website under resources for the duration of the seminar so that you can refer to them whenever you need to create your own personal vow. And honestly, I think you should open a file on your computer labeled vow and answer these questions one by one. And then you'll have a place to just keep coming back to and adding things and deepening your answers. And if you do it something like that, your answers will be cumulative and heartfelt and thorough. So here are the 10 questions. I'll go over them right now. First one, who am I? That's the first question, who am I? And when you answer this question, think of when you were a child and had dreams and passionate activities. Think of your job and what you choose to do or study outside of your work. What do you look forward to the most? Who are you when you're doing that thing? So these are ways to get at who am I? Who am I? It's a very important question and essential to know before you write your personal vow. The second question is, of all your qualities, which are the three that you hold most dear? And I suggest that you might list all your qualities and then select the three from there. List all your qualities. That's the second question. The third is, of all your skills, list the ones that are most valuable to you. So you list all your skills and then go, but this is really important and this, et cetera. And fourthly, are you a heart person or a mind person? So of the two ways, capital W, would you fall toward compassion or wisdom? Are you a compassion person or are you a wisdom person? And you might give some examples, by the way, if you do what I suggest, open a file and keep going back and writing, filling in more and more these answers. You might think of some examples of being a compassion person or a wisdom person. That's just a different way of saying, do you feel things more or do you think things more? Fifthly, is your life already shaped around one certain path that you can use as a mirror to see who you are? If not, do you see at least a general direction for this path? Each of us is unique. What are the most unique things about you? So it's kind of a two-part question. Do you already have a path? And if not, do you at least see a general direction toward that? That's kind of one part of the question. And the other is, what's unique about you? What are your special things? And sixthly, what has been your training? And when I say training, if you remember, I really mean Katagiri Roshi's bamboo stick. I hope you remember that. I think it was such a perfect way of describing training. And training is like in the military or something, when you're forced to do or conform to a set of rules that supersede your personal preferences. And it could be a job, a really demanding job, or school, becoming an artist or an athlete or a musician. Training means intense practice, day in and day out, not leisurely just doing what you want. And then seven, in stories of people's lives, what tends to move you the most? When you listen to the stories of people's lives, what really grabs you? Because that's interesting to notice. It tells you something about yourself. And that's what I'm asking you to learn about yourself. And the eighth question, what would be slightly beyond what you consider your capabilities in the area that you've identified as your direction? So if you're, let's say your direction is being a doctor, what would be, would neurosurgeon be beyond your capabilities, or what would be beyond your capabilities of whatever your direction? The ninth question is, how would you describe the main obstacles on your path? Or if you don't have a path, the main obstacles in forming a path? What are obstacles? Why don't you have a path already? What keeps getting in your way? And you might even do an inventory of all of your obstacles for your whole life. What's been the history of your obstacles? And see if there's a pattern in your obstacles. Has there always been a pattern? And is that same pattern hampering you now? What's going on? That's the ninth question. And the 10th question is, what on your deathbed would be unbearable to think that you have not accomplished? What on your deathbed would be unbearable to realize that you haven't accomplished? So those 10 questions, all of that, even the little explanations of the questions, that everything I just said will be posted under resources on the website for the duration of this entire seminar. And I encourage you to look at them constantly and to really, really consider each and every one at a time. Just take one at a time. They're very rich questions. And from there, I will ask you to draft a vow around which you might organize the rest of your life. So the vow is around something around which you can organize the rest of your life. And it should be very personal to you and touch you so deeply that you're inspired daily to do the practices that you've chosen to strengthen your connection with this promise to yourself. So, as you can see from what I just said, obviously, that's going to be the thrust of this seminar, and almost everything I say will be to help you make this happen. And really, this seminar is about you. You're the subject of the seminar. And to help you organize the rest of your life and make each and every day filled with meaning, so that you don't arrive on your deathbed thinking, you know, I always knew the most important thing was such and such, and I just never could get around to it. You know, just don't let that happen. Well, I've said a lot. I wonder if there are any questions.
Thank you, Gail. The first question that we have is, could you explain again what we are supposed to do? What is the connection between the 10 questions and our personal vow?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I don't want there to be any question about this, and others may be confused also. So think of it this way. Our personal vow is like, if you apply to go to college, or if you apply to a job, you need to have a statement of purpose. That's the first thing in a college application is, you know, what do you want to do here? Well, this is your life statement, but this is your statement of purpose for your life. What do you want to do here? Honestly, like, what do you want to do here? What are you here to do? What's up? It's kind of that simple. And knowing that, the next question is, how can I organize my life so that I'm sure to do that thing? How can I organize my life? So once you know what you want to do, then you'll know how you want to go about getting to having definitely done that thing. And so then you're back to what can I do today? Because, you know, the truth is we only have right here, right now. That, because we only have right here, right now, is why Dogen Zenji says practice and enlightenment are the same. Because there's no other time than right here, right now. And so if you're not working on your vow right here, right now, there's no other time. There is no other time. So we have to be, if we're not working on it right now, then we're not working on it. And if you don't know what your vow is, you can't work on it. So think of it as the same as writing a statement of purpose for college. But instead of college, it's your life. And you're writing a statement of purpose for your life. And once you have your statement of purpose, you can go. So let's say you're college. This is your statement of purpose. And so then, okay, well then, if that's my purpose, then I'm going to major in such and such. And if I major in such and such, I want to be sure to take X, Y, and Z classes. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking at the syllabus or the course curriculum, and I'm going to take that class starting right now. I'm signing up for it immediately. That's what I mean. I hope that's clear. Thank you. Thank you for asking.
So the next question that we have is a vow like a promise?
Yes. A vow is like a promise that you make to yourself. So, and it's a promise that you make to yourself that you're going to keep no matter what. So it's a really serious promise that you make to yourself. It's not, I'll think about that tomorrow. It's not like that. It's like, and it isn't like a stricture. It's like, in other words, it's not like that kind of promise, pointing your finger. It's like a loving promise. It's like, this will be so important and so fulfilling and so not expendable. It's essential for me to have whatever it is happen. And so I'm going to do whatever it takes. I remember feeling that way so completely about writing practice and becoming a writing poetry. I was just fierce about it, fierce about the practice of it, because it seemed so essential to me and essential to who I was. And that's the feeling you should have, no matter what. And I'll say this again, even though I said it in the, I think in the introduction to my book called One Continuous Mistake, Four Noble Truths for Writing and Writers. There was a group of runners, marathon runners in Japan. And I don't know how to pronounce the great Mount Hiei. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but anyway, that's where they lived, and they vowed to run a marathon every night, starting at midnight, they would run a marathon. And it's very steep. So they would run a marathon starting at midnight every single night. That was their vow. And they wore a little knife in their belt. And if they didn't complete their marathon, they would commit suicide. And it was that intention that I was suggesting in my book for writers, that they have that kind of intention for the practice of writing daily. And it's that kind of intention that I'm talking about now for you in your promise to yourself to be the person who does whatever it is. That's who you are, whatever, in other words, to be you, the promise to yourself, completely to be you. And you need to start that right now, right here, right now, to the best of your ability. And then as you write about it and think about those 10 questions, you will more thoroughly understand who you are and what's necessary for you to be doing every single day. So yes, it's a promise, but it's a promise to yourself, and it's a warm promise to yourself. It's not a guilt trip to yourself. It's a warm promise to yourself. I hope that's understandable. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is, what does our life is itself a vow mean?
So sometimes when we think about a vow, we're turned off because we think, oh, that means we have to do this this thing out there that someone's telling us to do, and it's going to be hard, and I don't really want to do it anyway. That's not what a vow is. That's like the military. But a vow is, our personal vow is not like the military. Our personal vow is fulfilling our deepest intuition and sense of why we have this lifetime, why have we incarnated as a human being, and we have a human mind, and we have human sensitivities and very complex inner organization. What are we here to do with it? And so when this expression, our life itself is a vow, it means that if someone looks back on your life, someone's with you when you die, and they look back at your whole life story, they will know what your vow is. And that's why I'm going to be telling you, starting in the fourth talk, there are 12 talks in this session. So starting in the fourth talk, I'm going to tell you five life stories of Soto Zen masters that are each very different. And you'll be able to tell their vow just by looking at their life. And that's what your life itself is a vow means. Our life itself is a vow. And so we want that to be the case. But first we need to know what is our life anyway. So once we know what is our life anyway, then our vow will be our life. We'll make our vow and it will be our life, and it will tell us what to do minute to minute. That's right. So, I mean, minute to minute, for example, I'm sorry.
Sorry. So we just got like a follow-up question on your previous answer. And the question is, how do you differentiate the knife story with pointing your finger?
Oh, pointing your finger is like someone else, you know, your mother, in a bad way. You know, you need to do such and such like that. That's what pointing your finger is. That's how I was using it. A vow, the knife in the runner story, the marathon runner story, is a self encouragement to overcome all obstacles to do your higher purpose, to what you have named as your higher purpose. This is your intention. It's not somebody else pointing a finger at you saying you should. It's you saying, I want to do this. And I want to do this so much that if I don't, and it's so meaningful to me and to who I am to have this expression of myself. If I fail myself, then I'm going to kill myself. It's, I'm not telling you should kill yourself if you fail, but it is important to be really severe with yourself. Severe is not a good word, but tough love, sort of like that would be a better expression. You need to do certain things in order to accomplish what you need to accomplish in this lifetime. And remember what Jung said, that human beings are slugs. So left to our own selves without these kind of guides, we'll do nothing. You know, we're couch potatoes, basically. That's Carl Jung says the human psyche is a slug. And slugs basically do nothing. They just crawl along. And so we need something. We need something. And the first thing we need is to know who we are and then be excited about that. And then be excited to, if you're a marathon runner, to run your marathons. And I myself wouldn't be that severe, but that the mind of that, of I need to do that no matter what. That mind is the way to become a Buddha, really. That mind, I need to practice no matter what. I need to sit, I need to be kind. I need to be thoughtful of others. I need to not be selfish. I need to not be arrogant. And I need to watch myself every minute, because as soon as I stop, one of those things is going to happen. I hope that explains it. it's the difference between someone else pointing a finger at you, wanting something that you didn't necessarily want, to wanting strictness in your own intentions so that you don't fail your own intentions. I hope that answers your question. Oops, I see we're out of time. And before I leave, I want to be sure to thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, for all of the work they do behind the scenes to make these talks possible. And I will see you next week. Bye-bye.